Welcome back to another episode of Keeping Up With Data podcast. Today, we're blessed with the presence of Tim Armstrong, Director of Data Technology and Product in Nova Entertainment. And my co-host,
Plain, data science recruiter. Thanks for coming along, Tim.
No worries. It's a pleasure to be here.
Welcome to Keeping Up With Data. Keeping Up With Data is the podcast that keeps data enthusiasts up to speed with what is happening in the data world. We bring in the leading minds from the data industry to talk all things career, news, embarrassing stories, failures, and successes.
I suppose, obviously, we always start with an intro, Tim. You've got an interesting background. Fill us in. How you got into data? Give us a synopsis.
I wouldn't always say interesting background, but I, like many people, I have a background. I think I encapsulate that as dairy farmer to data wrangler. In some way, shape or form, but obviously that also spreads a little bit wider than data. I think I was on a leadership offsite a couple of weeks ago and went to dinner with a few people in the business who I haven't really spent a lot of time with before, and they started to ask me, you know, you look after a lot of data and tech stuff at the business and there's a lot of cool things that you and your team are doing. How did you get to where you are? What did you study? Really, as I'm not a data scientist, I'm not a data practitioner, I'm not a technologist by trade. I came up with humble beginnings on the dairy farm, wanting to be an accountant because that was the way that I was going to earn some money to buy a farm and ultimately go back and run mum and dad's farm and take on that mantle as the eldest son in the family. And then I think really over time I just started to apply my ability to figure stuff out, fix problems, make stuff work to business, and naturally just evolved through sales and into operations and into data and technology. So it's been a unique journey for me, but I do find myself in a very fortunate position now where, you know, data and technology are at the forefront of a lot of businesses, regardless of industry, and I take great pleasure in being able to coach those coming up through businesses, but also being able to share with people insight and you know, under the hood sort of views of the power of technology and data. So it's been a little bit of a whirlwind. So I think overall I probably call it a little bit of calibration over time, is keep moving around until you sort of land where you do deliver and provide the most value, and then deeply rooted in the morals and ethics and the learnings of growing up on a dairy farm.
I didn't know you worked on a farm. I had that in the background. That's an interesting one. Maybe a totally different discussion than today. Yeah. But one question on the top of my mind, do you still have the farm?
My parents still have the farm that we grew up on. My grandparents, or my grandfather now, because my grandmother passed a couple of years ago, lives in the house next door at 96 years. Will be 96 in June this year. His birthday is actually on the same day as my youngest son, which is which is pretty cool. But mum and dad still very much run the farm that we grew up on. Obviously, they're a little bit, take more of a back seat now from a retirement standpoint. But very much get to the pleasure of going back to where I grew up whenever I want, which is pretty cool. And then probably for clarification, there are no sheep on the farm, even though it is in New Zealand. We just always have to to sort of get that one out of the way. Dairy cows only.
That was going to be my next question, actually. So glad you answered.
My next question is, do you use any data tools to help the farm in any way, shape or form? GIS, anything at all?
We do. We use a lot of data that tracks all of the production and the details about our animals. So there's a lot of testing that's done on a regular basis in terms of how much they're producing. I've become more and more interested over time in the agricultural industry and the application of data on that, because if I think about what we did back in the day, or back when I was on the farm, which is 20 odd years ago, versus what we can do now with technology, is a lot more in terms of, yeah, are you feeding your animals enough? Do they need extra nutrients or fertilizers in the pasture or in the food that they're eating? When's the best time to move them to once a day milking? So what's the rainfall, what's the impact of that on grass growth and the you know, the round, which effectively is how long does it take you to work around every paddock in the farm. So yeah, there's so much application for data, and even from a milk collection point of view, where back in the day they'd take a sample of milk, they'd give you a paper printout which told you how many litres of milk you produced or that they picked up from the farm, and then a while after that you would get a bit of analysis that had come back from the lab about the quality of the milk, and that then was built into your grading as a dairy farmer. Whereas now there are pieces of technology on that truck that do it on the spot. So you get this pretty comprehensive printout that obviously gets sent to you via email. It can go straight towards an application where you can track all of that stuff. So it's pretty insane the impact that has on farming. I think the caveat there though a little bit is that dairy farming has changed significantly. It's very much a lifestyle career. And I think that with the advent of the internet and the accessibility that people have living on farms to things outside of that now, does make it harder as well. So we definitely, in New Zealand, I think the most concerning piece about dairy farming is outside of the lifestyle. It's become very challenging for individuals to work and live on a farm away from everything else that's going on as well.
Very true. And you can definitely use data in any way, shape or form for practical solutions, which is great. But I suppose onto the main event, which is what we're here for, is to talk around data, not just from a farming perspective, but from an entertainment perspective. We're going to touch on CDP, customer data platforms, stakeholder buy-in, controversial one, maybe generalist versus specialist in industry. So I suppose we'll start with Nova Entertainment around what you guys are doing, customer data, and understanding that CDP is kind of taking a front seat in that industry right now and is becoming very much a very common theme. So maybe start with CDP, what it is, a bit of a background into it, and then what you guys are using to apply it in Nova.
Yeah, look, I think there's been a lot of noise around CDPs in the last few years. A lot of, you know, rightly or wrongly, it's been a pocket of the sector that has evolved really quickly, and I think it's probably evolved from a technological capability point of view at a faster rate as businesses have from a strategic thinking perspective. Definitely the role that a CDP plays, whether it's packaged or composable or federated, is really around allowing you to bring a little bit more standardization to the customer data that you collect, allowing you to run a process called identity resolution, which basically starts to look at things like, if I receive a piece of data from a listening session on this mobile application and it's connected to an email address that belongs to Tim, how do I make sure that if I receive something similar from a website that Tim's also listening to in a logged in state, that we make sure that those activities are joined together, because at the end of the day, they all belong to Tim. There's the capability there of really being able to create audiences out of that. So how do I create like-minded audiences or groups of people within my customer ecosystem that make sense based on what our business needs are, and then the ability to pass that downstream to other platforms, because the CDP is not a standalone piece of technology that operates in its own little vacuum or silo. It is the center point for your customer data facilitation within your business. And if I talk about that in context of Nova, when I joined the business back in 2020, mid-COVID or start of COVID, there wasn't really a clear data strategy. I think there was an appetite and an understanding that we have an opportunity, but not really a definition of what that looks like. So as we sort of looked at that, we were very fortunate at the time that when I joined, you know, there was a lot of movement in the digital side of the business. I came in to report and work with a guy called Fyad Tomi, who went on to work at ARN post Nova, which was a bit of a fun time as he jumped ship to a competitor. But there was a lot of scope there for us to really give digital a go. How do we make this a really solid part of the radio business? And in doing that, we had the time and space in that to really think about what our strategy should be longer term, how we thought about what those points of value were across that strategy, and then start to think about the technologies and the stuff that brings those to life. And the CDP really became the center point for that, based on the fact that A, we collected data from consumers, or we had the opportunity to collect data from consumers, and we collected customer data across other parts of the business as well. Mm-hmm. We obviously at that time didn't utilize it very well, so that was part of that mentality when we thought about that. We then also acknowledged that audio is not the first digital channel to evolve in this space. We'd seen display evolve over time, mobile advertising, mm-hmm. we had native advertising, we went through all the process around first party data utilization and activation. We saw video explode because mm-hmm. that's really the best way to describe video. And we saw a lot of sophistication in the digital market about how they wanted to trade those digital channels. Mm-hmm. Audio is a very different landscape to video. Same, but different is what we always say, because it's a, you know, audio visual is very complementary and fits well together. But the environments in which that content is consumed is done under very different conditions. So we had an idea from that of what the potential was, and that's kind of set us out. So it really, when we started that process, after we put that strategy in place, the customer data platform was really the center point of that, by which everything else longer term would have some tie or connection into, in terms of us being able to mobilize that data around the business and use that internally for cross-functional decision making, whether that was what content do we generate, what new stations do we spin up, what editorial content do we put forward, how do we manage our social channels, what platforms do we want to be on, what are we doing and how do we guide our product development, what insights can we extract to support the decisioning around content acquisition, decisioning around go to market from a commercial point of view, and then obviously working towards longer term of how we start to, in a privacy first way and a privacy conscious way, monetize that first party data as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I'm seeing it more and more often. I suppose one question would be, has it derived from something maybe 10 years ago that was similar, that now CDP is like taken shape from what something used to be? Or
the first real iteration, and you know, your data management platform or DMP was probably the first one. There was probably more based on third-party data, was capable of handling some of the digital identity signals that exist in the ecosystem, and then I think, like everything, is that, you know, as we moved into GDPR leading the world in terms of changing privacy regulations in the European market, there became more and more of a focus on first party data. And then there kind of came this need to go, is there a tool that can better manage it? Because you always get to that position, right? Do we bastardize the DMP and make that support first party data and then have a solution that's not quite fit for purpose? Mm-hmm. Or do we go and think about a new concept that can then over time replace the DMP? And that's, you know, when I joined Nova, that was a big decision point. We had a platform in place, which was more of a DMP at the time. And that was expensive, but it was also not fit for purpose. And when we did that strategy, we went, actually, you know what? That platform is not going to help us achieve that. So therefore, we need to move to something a little bit more specialized. It meant that we could reduce the investment in that specialized piece of technology. And effectively, the CDP was going to better serve us for what we wanted to achieve longer term.
And CDP then, does that have your data governance already kind of embedded in it as a platform, rules around it, or?
It has a little bit. I think if you looked at that sort of particular space at the moment, you have your traditional data warehouses, lakes, then you have your CDPs, then you have your engagement platforms. For the most part, you'll find a lot of companies using CDPs. Their sort of main single source of truth still in many cases is their data lake or the data warehouse. Mm-hmm. There's often only the data sent to the CDP is done in a fashion that is all about in alignment with use cases and what that's needed for. So you still have a wide range of governance controls and elements sitting within your data lake, your data warehouse, but then you also have built-in stuff within the CDPs. You probably would have maybe seen in the last few weeks, obviously MI3 revisited a lot of work they did around CDPs a couple of years ago. And within that, there's still some work for the CDPs to do in that space around some of the governance stuff, because at the end of the day, you know, they're a tech platform. So the data that you put in there, there's an expectation that the right and necessary consents and opt-ins and T's and C's have been in place and have been acknowledged before the data goes into that platform. And then you obviously have pretty good control over where the data goes. And if I thought about some of the downstream platforms that leverage our CDP, or at least leverage the data within it, they don't pass any of that PII data on. Yeah. You know, it's either using tokenization or anonymization, hashing, any of those kind of privacy practices, be able to make sure that, you know, there's no traceability throughout the business. Because if you thought about where a piece of personal data could get within your business if you're not across it and you're not governing it, it could get everywhere. And if we think about what's coming down the path in terms of regulatory change, there could very well come a point in time where there are spot audits that goes, I need to know every piece of customer data in your business, and I need to know where it is, and I need to know, and for example, if Tim Armstrong comes in and unsubscribes, I want you to give me a surety that every single platform that has touched that data no longer has a trace of it, because you know, there is a right to be forgotten there. So it's complex, and you end up with governance and multiple, you end up with platform-based governance, and then you have your business or corporate-wide governance to tie into that.
Yeah, makes sense. And I suppose given it being a data platform in a sense, probably leads me on to my next question, tech debt, et cetera, is it a platform that can be like your AWS's, where one day you can wake up and you can have a hell of a lot of problems and you're death has gone skyrocketing for the issues? Or
look, with mParticle in particular, because it is a packaged CDP, then all of those, that functionality is contained within that platform. It means that any sort of upkeep or management of the features and functionalities and the core operating capability of that platform is all managed by the vendor. So I think that's, from that point of view, we're in a good spot when it comes to that. I think where the technical debt probably comes in a little bit there is really around, you know, how do you, that process of when you connect the CDP to your platforms or you connect it to a downstream platform. I think talking probably more broadly about technical debt, I do very much believe there is good technical debt and bad technical debt. And I want that to sound like that it comes from a point of view that you want to have technical debt. It comes from the point of view that some technical debt that you have actually has no bearing on anything else you're doing in the business, and therefore what does the intent become in terms of getting rid of that? Because it takes time and effort, and that time and effort to remove that and tidy things up is then taking away from other projects that need to be delivered or fulfilled as part of business expectations and business strategy. And then I think, on the technical debt front, you know, there's this delicate balance that you have to run around perfection versus something that's good enough to deliver what it needs to deliver in respect of what you're working on and why you're working on it, and the compliance elements around that in your ecosystem. Because we all know, without, you know, digging into it too much, we don't have the time to make everything perfect.
Yeah, I think it's similar. Like people you hear in the property industry, not all debt is bad debt. Like you can have 10 properties and be 10 million in debt, but if you look at it from a longer term perspective, it's good in a sense. Which probably leads into the next part around two topics, I suppose, the perfectionism in a tool, but also from a stakeholder perspective in a business. If you're seeing this debt and you don't actually know what the hell it's all about, you're not a technical guy, you can just see the money, which most stakeholders do. How do you as a director get buy-in from stakeholders? And from a broader perspective, there's always that trouble with, we need to get this signed off. Is it going to bring in money? What's like, fill us in on your experience in that.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, and you'll find many different perspectives on that. I think, you know, two parts. One is really around that perfectionism piece. If you look at the market across the last 2 to 3 years, nearly every business, or at least a large majority of businesses, has faced some kind of financial pressure. And that financial pressure has been a result of the economy and world events, because we've definitely had no shortage of those in the last few years. And then, you think about that coming off the back of COVID, which was a black swan event that probably no one ever thought that we could have that level of shutdown across the world. So the perfectionism piece really comes into play now when we start to think about some of the changes that happened in businesses in the last 2 to 3 years were cost driven. We need to downsize. We need to better control our cost base or reduce that. We need to deliver increased profitability. We need to do more with less. So how do we make that work? The reality of that is that we probably saw a lot of large data and technology projects stop. And we saw a lot of people associated to those technology and data projects exit the business in the form of redundancy in many cases. And what that is a result of is a CFO in many cases, or the executive, taking a very non-emotional, cost-driven approach to where we can save money. And if you think about the lost opportunity in that, is that's the lost opportunity is the fact that in many of those cases, the business value was not being seen. The projects were running over time, over budget. There was always the narrative of we need more people, we need more money. And it was too long between delivery of value back to the business. So the game has kind of switched a little bit now, where sometimes you have to make something work now for the executive to see it, to then get confidence in it, to then have a level of assurity that, hey, this can be delivered for this much money in this much time. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I kind of like that. It means, and I know we might get to that question about generalism versus specialism a little bit later, but it sets up nicely for that, right? Because it means that the profile of a data technology leader has needed to change. And I think longer term, that change is positive because it kind of shifts away from that cost center mentality to more of a value delivery center mentality. And then the other side of that around the technical debt, it's really around educating, right? A lot of senior technical leaders, be it technology or data, they will all tell you that more and more of their time is spent managing up and storytelling, change management, bringing people on the journey. So technical debt is, I think it's normal, and definitely with the work that I've been doing at Nova across the range areas of the business that I work across, we've spent a lot of time trying to help decode the technical jargon around that and normalize it for the executive to help them understand, hey, you know, if we invest, engineering as an example, we invest X amount of money in this calendar year, be aware that X percentage of that is going to go to maintenance. And that conversation early on was probably a little bit harder because, are you saying that X percent of that budget is going to purely just maintenance? And then trying to explain the reasons for that as well. And I think that this is where the utilization of, examples or analogies comes in very strong and being able to help them resonate with that. And I think one of the ones that I've always had a lot of success with or felt has worked well for me and served me well has been the analogy of a house. Is you build a 3-bedroom house. When you do that, you put down a foundation to support a 3-bedroom house. So if in 5 years' time you end up having 4 children and all of a sudden you need some extra bedrooms, it's not about just building an extra room. You have to think about, are the foundations of the house right to support a 4th bedroom? Is all the infrastructure within, the electricity, the plumbing, everything else within the house, are they equipped to handle more people living in the house than was initially built for? And then by that, you can continue to build on that analogy over time. And then you go, well, actually, you know what? There's a dependency here that, yeah, if I build that extra room, I have to put it, or I need to put in more electricity, or I need to put in more plumbing. And then I need to expect that longer term, there's going to be higher electricity bills and higher water costs. And then I need to think about the fact that that will also put pressure on other parts of the house. And that may mean that as a result of having extra people living there, other parts of the house need to undergo more regular maintenance.
Does the fuse board need to be updated?
Yeah, exactly right. So if you start to think about that, there's so many different ways that you can start to use it. An analogy is a common analogy in that communication, that narrative, and use that as an opportunity to kind of help people resonate with what's actually happening here without dragging them into the technical weeds. Because I think that's where you can go wrong pretty quickly. And it probably happened to me earlier on where I had the opportunity with the executive 3 or 4 years ago or longer when I started. I was probably more, I would often default to the technical side of things because that's where I was most comfortable. And then once you start to see that not landing, then you have to go away and, well, how do I change that approach? And how do I bring the technical into a common language that connects more to business value as opposed to the technical practice? And then how do I communicate that in a consistent story that I can build upon over time in a way that that audience, who aren't always going to be a technical audience, can walk away going, I understand that. That makes sense to me.
I think that's definitely the best analogy I have most definitely heard. I love it. And I did actually put a post on LinkedIn probably a couple of years back, maybe not a couple of years back, but a few years back, about break down data engineering into the most simplest of analogies. And loads of people were putting one in. And I think David Howell had put one in around, you look at it from a plumber perspective. It's, if your house is fully operational, your hot water is running, if your taps are running, nobody's complaining. But when it breaks, everyone knows who to call and go mad at the plumber because it's broken. But I think your one definitely trumps that. So I might steal that for a post in itself further down the line. But I suppose that brings us in then to the generalism and specialism approach around not having a perfect polished article to present. Stakeholders obviously want to see that perfect polished article and be able to envision the ROI of what you're communicating to them, which touches on the managing up rather than managing down. The people below need to know what they need to build because you're communicating that to them, but the people above don't have the technical acumen to understand it. But breaking it down into the simplistic of forms makes people be able to walk through it and understand it. What's your take on the specialism versus generalism approach? Because I won't go too deep into it, but I was always an advocate that you've got to be a specialist in the sense of engineering fundamentals.
Look, I think the age-old answer is it depends, right? But if I think about it, and I think about it more broadly from a business perspective, you could very much say at this point in time or in the stage that many businesses are at, having a super technical person sitting in your executive team isn't necessarily an asset. And what I mean by that is that executive level in particular is becoming more and more business savvy. So you find there are executives who are leading teams that don't sit in their wheelhouse, teams that are outside of teams that they've managed before in the past. But the reality is no one really goes into the board and talks about data engineering. They go in and talk about this new product that we're going to generate that's going to help us increase revenue by 10% this year. And then those subsequent conversations are, how are we tracking to that 10%? It's not, well, we can't connect the pipelines in the background. It's, the project has hit some snags. We've figured out that maybe, you know, a competitor has delivered something similar, and that 10% is now 8%. And now we're figuring out how we make up that 2% differential somewhere else. So I think overarchingly, if we look at tech and data teams, I think it's about composition. It's about having, it's like a rugby team, right? Being a Kiwi, I'll talk about rugby. So having the right players in the right position where they are going to deliver their maximum. So for example, you know, you're not going to play a fly half or a first five in the hooker position because you need to be a hooker to play the role in the middle of the scrum to hook that ball back and throw it into the line out. And if you don't have any more hookers left on the bench, then you have to change the rules of the game. So it's about having the right blend. But you'll often also notice that the captains in a lot of those teams aren't necessarily specialist players. They're more generalist in nature. They might be able to play two or three different positions. And if they don't play any more than those positions. They understand the fundamentals of all the other positions and how they all need to work together to deliver an outcome, which in the realm of sport is a victory. So I think it comes down to composition. I think if you're talking about, if you're going to do a project, you say, right, we need to do a data transformation. We've got a bunch of on-premise data services. We want to migrate all those to the cloud. And the goal of that is really to deliver additional utility for the business. And that is measurable in value. You're going to want a generalist. If you then need a bunch of people to work within that team to help shift all that across, then you're going to need a specialist. So I think you still need specialists at a very laser-focused SME level. But as you get up into the leadership elements of that, generalism becomes more important because you need to be a business leader, not necessarily a data and tech leader. And look, as an example, with myself, you know, my last job at Switch Media, we were building video technology. I had four engineers and a software architect. I'd never managed one engineer before in the past, but it's well outside my comfort zone. But where success came was being able to manage up and understand the business needs, and then manage down by connecting the business needs to the technical needs and have that sort of translation layer there as well. But what I also think is important, and this has definitely been, we've had to do a lot, not a lot at Nova, in terms of maximize what we can do with what we've got. A lot of the people we've had come into the business have had not a lot of depth of technical expertise, but they've had a capability to understand the context of the business and bring that to the technical specialism. And then they've had the capability to learn the specialism. And I kind of look at that as well, even in the context of people, is that if you purely look at hard skills and soft skills, harder to teach the soft skills, easier for someone to learn the hard skills. And at the end of the day, thinking about a world where all projects are getting more scrutiny than ever before, there's more focus on value delivery, there's more focus on timing and tangibility, then you want to be in a position where the work that's getting done is done in context of what's important to the business and the why. And therefore, I think you need a good mix of generalists, I think, leading a team or leading an initiative or a program of work, who can then kind of play that translator between executive board and the SME.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I don't retract really my good statement, but I...
You've converted me, Tim, I think, but I'm on Sean's side. Ooh. But especially within that leadership element, over the last 2 years especially, we've seen, obviously, cost-cutting measures, transformational changes, those who can adapt, those who have a more generalist background typically have been more successful. As you've mentioned, if you're quite specialised in what you've done and the organisation changes at the executive level, you know, where does that lead you? Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're still that technical communicator, that bridge between the two, if you will, the business and the tech, then I've found mostly that those have had more success. And that's where interest has come from both our partners, both candidates, you know, where can I apply skill sets and experiences, yep, in a changing landscape.
Yep.
You talk about AI, new things, machine learning, etc. I've found that those technical communicators have adapted quicker than those who specialise.
And it's not easy for those who have known one thing for a long time either. I think that's been my other observation. If I think about conversations I've had with people in the market who are looking, or people who have jobs who are looking, which seems to be just as many. when you start to dig into the work they do and what they are frustrated about within their current environment or within the job market that they are looking around at, I think that many of them are very used to being leaned on for their technical expertise. And I think that for many of them, the level that they're at now, that's the lowering of importance around that has shocked them a little bit. And for some of them, it's probably impacting the ability to find a new opportunity, rightly or wrongly. But then also there's a very large process for many of them of unlearning, right? Because what would you say if you had to take a guess at it, is the first thing someone does when they lose their job. It's like, go and try to
call precision sourcing.
After they do that, they go and try to brush up on their technical skills, because they're actually, you know what, I just need to brush up on these new areas and I need to brush up on my technical skills, and that's going to help me get a new job. Whereas it should be things like, well, what training is there out there for speaking? You know, because if I'm in a senior leadership role and I'm on a reasonable wicket and I'm pushing, you know, high level head of or just on the cusp of C-level, that's one of the most important skill sets you'll have, is how can I sit in the room and have a constructive conversation with an executive team or a board that tells a story, that talks about the value, that doesn't get everyone lost in technical jargon. And that's a big change for people, right? So there's this process of unlearning how you've done things in the past and going and learning new skills, but then also being able to kind of create and find opportunities and net through your network and other of how you start to practice that, right? I think for me, one thing that I've found very useful in my career is that in my last job, I went to a lot of trade shows. I'm an introvert by nature, but I forced myself to go to these trade shows because I said, you know what, you've got an opportunity here to sell products and you should take that, because your ability to sell is going to be important longer term if you continue to work in the data and tech space. Because if it's, you might be sitting in front of a PE firm or a VC firm, or you might be sitting in front of a potential acquirer, or you're asking a board for an investment in a big project, you need to be able to get them to buy into the idea, and you're not going to get that through out-teching them. If you go technical on them, they'll probably glaze over and pull back. And how many times do you see, I guess, the focus on, if you go out and you become a co-founder and you're not technical, the first thing you should don't do is find a technical co-founder. So you can have that kind of combination to work on how you make sure that whilst the technical is sound and safe, then you as a non-technical person can sell it in, or over time the technical person sell it. And I think the podcasting industry, I think, is really interesting. Like there are a lot of really interesting innovations coming out in podcasting. I think it's just ripe for innovation at this point in time. And I've met a lot of CEOs of businesses who have created startups in that space focused on that particular area, and they have great products, but they can't sell them. The problem is they can sit in a room and we can talk technical and I can have a really great conversation because I want to know how it all works. But if I put them in front of a commercial person or an executive or a board, they run out of road really quickly because they're very good at telling you how the product works, but they haven't quite figured out how to sell it. And I think that's the next step, right? I think there's startups out there who have failed or had faced challenges in the past, who have had very amazing products, amazing technical people leading those businesses, but they haven't quite figured out that storytelling, selling aspect of it.
Absolutely. It's an interesting point you bring up, because a lot of, I'd say 95% of candidates who are looking for a job, the first thing they'll say to me is, I've done this course, or I'm brushing up on my technical skills here. Rarely do I ever hear speaking events, communication sort of courses, public speaking. A lot of people struggle with that. And now that you mention it, I think that's probably a skill gap that people aren't focusing on too much, that they could take forward to sort of elevate their profile above, you know, the immensely competitive talent pool where thousands of engineers all know how to use SQL, Python, C++, whatever the coding language is. But if you're going to deliver a product or sell it in, how can you translate those business things to make it valuable to the commercial leader?
I do sense a new business unit evolving out of precision sourcing after this.
Do tell.
Well, you go and train people with these skills, right?
It's definitely a mindset shift. I think, I don't know whether COVID had it in more emphasis in the market on it, but definitely I'd seen since COVID, there's been a major shift towards the business, the value, understanding the business, forget about the tech. Not forget about the tech, but for ourselves, even speaking with people, high level, mid level, whatever it may be, when we're understanding about the profiles, it's always, I've worked on AWS, I've built this, I've done that, I've did this. It's like, I can see that on your resume, but what I can see is the value of what you've put on your resume. Quantify your achievements. What have you done to, what is the purpose of that pipeline? Like peeling everything back to almost layman's terms. You don't need fancy tech jargon. You need to be able to speak to people about what you've done and the value that it had.
Yeah.
The tech will come.
It does. Yeah. It's kind of triggers another point though too, right? Is if you think about a lot of very smart engineers, be it technology or data, most of them are pretty humble individuals as well, right? And the last thing they like to do is talk about themselves. So it's easy for them to say, well, I use these platforms. But if you go, yeah, what, you know, hey, your business did a big project in this space, or what was your contribution to that? They're not often forthcoming with that information. It's something you have to extract out of them through question. Yeah. And then if you thought about some of the general experiences or some of the things that people are talking about in terms of how their job search is going, where they never get the opportunity to sit down with someone and have a conversation and actually articulate those kind of things, it's like they have to be asked to talk about it. And if they then proactively put it front and center on their CV or what resume or whatever they put forward in the application process, they kind of don't feel comfortable with it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's like, well, it's that fine line of, I don't want to feel like I'm boasting, but I also, my intent here is try to find a job as well. So how do I find a balance in that?
Yeah, I think it's also part of Australian culture as well, like tall poppy syndrome, right? Like you don't typically talk about yourself in such high regard. So people do struggle with that. Sometimes we have to pry it out of them to say, come on, no, what did you do? I don't care about your team because I'm not interviewing your team at the moment. Like it's great what you did as a contribution, but yeah, being able to sort of get that out of them has been, I think, a struggle for us at times. Yeah. But then on the other side, you do get those very confident engineers who talk too much about the tech and then forget to actually elaborate on their people skills as well. So it's a fine line, it's a hard balance to, to find.
I'll use your terminology versus that, the half-baked solution. It's like you're selling yourself, but you're not. That's my take on it. I suppose the final piece before we wrap this one up, obviously Pauline's AI on data engineering. I think you've got some questions around like AI in the media industry.
Yeah.
What's going on?
What's going on? How does it differ? Obviously, I know that the data can, the way it's structured, or I guess, not structured, sorry, the way that it's used as value for a business within media and entertainment may be a bit different to a traditional like finance and energy, whatever it is. Where is AI headed in entertainment? I know there's a lot around audio generation, video generation, etc. But where do you see the value, I suppose?
Yeah, I think at the moment, the easiest way to describe it is the path of least resistance is the amount of audio creative solutions that have spun up out there to say, well, we, you know, instead of you create 100 renditions of this audio ad, we can create that in a click of a button and we can do it super, super cheap. But I think everything, again, has to be grounded in what are we trying to do? And if we can do it, what does it mean to the business? I like to normalize AI a little bit and say, you know, for me, it's just another tool and toolkit. It's just another tool and toolkit. I don't think there should be an intent around using AI. Using AI to solve a problem should be more of an outcome of the understanding of a problem and what you need to achieve off the back of it. But yeah, it's interesting, right? You know, we see a lot of technology out there that poses, I wouldn't say a threat, but it creates an opportunity for people to think that over time, could our radio stations be 100% synthetic from the point of view that we have programmed music, but all of the talking from talent in between the ad breaks and at drive and afternoons or breakfast and drive, could that be replaced? You know, could you, let's aim at our competitor for a second there, because they spend a ridiculous amount of money on two celebrities who are front and center of their radio show, like ridiculous amount of money. Could you replicate that with AI? I think there's no arguing that over time we can. I think it's more a question of how long is it before we get there, if we get there, what does it mean for our business? You know, if you could, what was it, $200 million deal that they did over X amount of years? Mm. Imagine if you pulled that out of your business. Imagine pulling that much cost out of your business and go, well, we can spend $1 million across that period of time with an AI tool that does exactly what you do for us right now. Does that change your listeners? Maybe in the short run, but if you think that capability is going to get there over time, I think the interesting thing that I really see is just that ability to analyze text and speak at a faster and faster rate, and then be able to make decisions and actions off the back of that. Radio, for the most part, still operates off a diary-based system for measurement. That is evolving, and it's evolved a lot since I've been at Nova. It's more digital now than it has ever been, but it's still tied up in a radio survey that happens 8 times a year. And we just know that with the way that society is at the moment, we just change. Like, we have our flavors of the month and our flavors of the day, and in some cases, flavors of the hour, and we can skip from everything is so much accessible for us. So I think there's a real big opportunity operationally. I think traditional broadcast radio businesses, very high profit, high margin. Digital, not so high profit, not so high margin, and it kind of waters it down a little bit. So I think there's some really interesting things that we can expect in the operational efficiency part there, whether it's how we engage our listeners, how we generate content, what kind of content we generate, how we automate all of the, or a large amount of the trading around audio advertising across broadcast and digital, how we then automate some of the work that happens within roles. So I think, will the size of our workforce decrease? Yes. When will it decrease? Probably don't know. Will we get operational efficiencies? Yes, we will. But between now and then, we've got a lot of stuff to sort out.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of stuff to figure out, because I think there's also, within many businesses, there is still a load of debt, good and bad debt. Mm-hmm. And some of that's been, you know, no investment focus over a period of time. You know, do we have the right tool sets? Do we have the right tools for our people? All that kind of stuff. So there's huge, huge potential. I don't think you could fathom how much potential there is. Mm-hmm. Like many industries, I think it's more about how we keep working towards realizing that over time. Because again, I'm not a fan of having an AI strategy. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of having AI as an option to solve business problems and create new opportunities. Mm-hmm. But in my mind, it shouldn't be deliberate. It should be incidental.
Yeah.
It's all in the toolkit. I like that.
It's definitely like a controversial topic around, you've mentioned the presenters being AI, potentially fully AI. My counter argument to that would be, I've seen firsthand in the last 2 years, ample amount of startups, AI startups, fail because of the way they've led with bot style interviews or bot style, whatever it may be, or voice recognition AI, that you're just speaking to AI throughout X, Y, and Z. And that was what they were leading with, and it failed. But it kind of brings me around to the customer perspective of the engagement piece. Like, you listen to people and you get bought in by people, and you're like, oh, you can hear about their life. Yeah. They talk about things off the cuff. I suppose that's a whole other topic.
Yeah, I think
definitely a whole other.
One thing radio has is that, and I've said this before,
personability.
A few times is that emotive connection, right? Like, the decision to turn the radio onto the car, in the car on your way to drop the kids off at school to listen to Fitzy Whipper and Kate. It's not a subconscious, it becomes subconscious, because it's like they're your friends and they're talking in a one-to-one soul environment, and you feel part of the conversation. And that's, I think, the attractiveness of podcasts as well, right? So radio, I think, will continue to have that. I think it's important radio maintains that, because I think it is that personal connection that people have with the talent over time, that makes them want to come back, which makes them want to listen more, which makes them align to a specific station.
It's the balance, isn't it? Trying to get it right could be make or break for some.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, I think that brings us to a natural end. Good conversation, Tim, and stay tuned for the episode, folks.
Cool. Thanks for having me.